Our last episode left us staring into a pretty dark hole. Churches were emptying, colleges had gone rationalist, the frontier was largely unchurched, denominations were talking about merging out of sheer desperation. A sitting bishop of the Episcopal Church had essentially quit. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court wrote to a friend that the church in America was too far gone to recover. It was 1798. And by 1830, the United States was in the middle of one of the most extraordinary spiritual awakenings in the history of the Christian church. So what happened in between? That's what we're going to be talking about today. And I'll tell you right now, it starts with prayer. It almost always does. To appreciate what God did in the Second Great Awakening, you have to understand what the world looked like going in. And we covered the American end of it last time. But the spiritual crisis wasn't just an American problem. It was transatlantic. In France, the revolution hadn't merely separated church and state. It had attempted to annihilate Christianity entirely. The new regime declared Christianity illegal. Churches were locked, priests imprisoned or exiled or executed by the hundreds. The calendar was rewritten to erase the Christian week. And on November 10th of 1793, the Cathedral of Notre Dame, that great Gothic monument to the glory of God built over two centuries, was formally renamed the Temple of Reason. Now, what happened inside Notre Dame that November day was one of the most audacious pieces of political theater in history. The revolutionaries had built an artificial mountain in the nave, complete with a small Greek temple dedicated to philosophy. At the climax of the ceremony, an actress, the wife of one of the organizers, was dressed in classical robes and carried in on a palanquin, enthroned as the goddess of reason before a cheering crowd. The high altar was replaced with an altar to liberty. Statues of philosophers stood where the saints had once stood. The constitutional bishop of Paris, Gaubet by name, he stripped off his vestments and publicly renounced his ordination. The crowds chanted, "No more priests, no more God, except the God of nature." Well, meanwhile, the French were aggressively exporting their ideas. Revolutionary money flowed across the Atlantic to promote the new philosophy in American colleges. It found a receptive audience, particularly among students who were less interested in justice and reason than in the immorality that came packaged with it. As every generation of college students discovers about trendy ideologies. In Germany, Switzerland, and the Netherlands, rationalism had taken over the academies. In Britain, the philosopher David Hume had made skepticism fashionable among the educated classes. His attacks on miracles and on the foundations of faith are still assigned reading in university philosophy departments to this day. Voltaire, writing from Paris, declared that Christianity would be confined to the dustbin of history within just 30 years. He was wrong, as it turned out. Profoundly wrong. Now, the campus scene in America was alarming. At Harvard, polls found that most students identified as atheist. At Princeton, founded by the Presbyterians to train their ministers, there were said to be only two students who would openly profess the Christian faith. Students formed what contemporaries called the filthy speech movement. Buildings were burned. College presidents were driven to resign. Mobs attacked churches during their services. Christians meeting in groups had to do so quietly, the way that people meet secretly when meeting openly is dangerous. Yeah, it was a generation that looked in every conceivable way like a generation that had lost its faith, and perhaps it had. But the generation before it had been praying. The story of the Second Great Awakening begins not with a revival meeting, but with a book, a letter, and a chain of prayer that took, well, it took decades to ignite. So let's go back to the 1740s, right in the middle of the First Great Awakening. In Scotland, a group of evangelical ministers had organized their congregations into regular, what they called concerts of prayer. Now, these were set times each week in smaller groups, and then with a much larger group every 3 months, when believers would come together specifically to pray for revival. One of those ministers was a young pastor named John Erskine. Now, Erskine sent an account of the Scottish prayer movement to Jonathan Edwards in New England. Edwards was electrified by what he read. In 1748, he published what may be the single most important document in the history of revival prayer. Its title was this: A Humble Attempt to Promote Explicit Agreement and Visible Union of God's People in Extraordinary Prayer for the Revival of Religion and the Advancement of Christ's Kingdom on Earth. Now, that was the title of the work, not the entire contents. In it, Edwards made a simple but profound case from Scripture. The same God who promises revival also promises to respond to the united prayer of His people. He argued that extraordinary movements of revival in church history, including Pentecost, were preceded by extraordinary prayer. In other words, if you want revival, pray for it. Pray for it specifically, persistently, and together. Edwards died in 1758, 10 years after writing that book, having seen only the beginning of what he had hoped for. Okay, fast forward to 1784. Edwards had been in his grave for 26 years. But his book is still in circulation at that time. The elderly John Erskine, living in Edinburgh, came across a copy and sent it to an English Baptist minister named John Ryland in Northamptonshire. Ryland read it and was deeply moved by it and shared it with a small circle of his friends, one of whom was a young shoemaker turned scholar just beginning to feel the tug of the mission field. His name was William Carey. In 1784, the same year the American Methodist Episcopal Church was organized at Baltimore, that small group of Baptist ministers in Northamptonshire launched what became known as the Concert of Prayer. They committed to pray together the first Monday of each month, asking God to pour out His Spirit and to open the nations to the gospel. Within just a few years, the practice had spread to dozens of other Baptist churches. Then the Congregationalists joined with them. Then Anglicans and Methodists. And within 7 years, Britain was laced with a network of monthly prayer meetings, all asking for the same thing: send revival. Now Carey, inspired by those prayer meetings, sailed for India in 1793 and launched the modern Protestant missionary movement. The revival in Britain began showing fruit by 1791. One group of people praying in England would, over the next 60 years, change the entire shape of Christianity on the globe. The British revival was well underway by the early 1790s. It began in Yorkshire, where people who'd come to the monthly prayer meetings to mock them went home converted. Some meetings were quiet, others were noisy. The Holy Spirit, it turns out, seems to specialize in blowing up people's expectations. In Leeds, the Methodist Church saw 1,000 unbelievers come to faith in just a matter of months. The revival spread to every denomination, and it upended some firmly held theological assumptions along the way. You see, the Congregationalists and the Baptists in England believed that conversion, that was a long, careful process. You needed months of conviction before you could claim to be converted, and then several more months of demonstrating the fruit of conversion before anyone would take your claim seriously. Before the revival, the idea that an alcoholic could walk into a church meeting and walk out converted, dramatically, genuinely, permanently changed, that was deemed theologically reckless. Then they started seeing it happen in their own churches again and again. Their theology didn't change the reality changed their theology. Reality has a way of doing that. The revival strengthened the hand of evangelicals in the Church of England. Most famously, William Wilberforce and the group around him known as the Clapham Sect. Wilberforce spent the next 4 decades fighting to abolish the slave trade and then slavery itself. The direct line from revival prayer to Northamptonshire to the abolition of British slavery is one of the most consequential chains of cause and effect in modern history. And from England, the revival moved into Scotland, then swept Wales. By 1796, it had covered Norway. A spiritual fire that started in one county in England was blazing now across northern Europe. One of the most characteristic things about genuine revival is that it multiplies ministries. New needs become visible and people step up to meet them. The British Awakening produced one of those moments, and it started with a 15-year-old Welsh girl and a pair of, well, bare feet. Mary Jones was born in 1784 in rural Wales. She was the daughter of weavers, and from childhood, she had one consuming desire. She wanted to own her own Bible, in Welsh, of course. and the nearest copy was at a farm 2 miles away, and so she would walk there to read it. She began saving every penny that she could earn doing odd jobs. It took her 6 years. In the spring of 1800, aged 15, she set out barefoot on a 26-mile walk over mountainous Welsh terrain to the town of Bala, where a minister named Thomas Charles had Welsh Bibles for sale. She arrived to find that the copies were already claimed. She began to weep. Now, Charles was so moved by her story, this girl had walked 26 miles barefoot for a Bible, that he found a way to give her one anyway. Now, by some accounts, he gave her 3 of them. Mary Jones lived to be 80 years old and treasured those Bibles until the day that she died. Her annotated copy survives to this day. Thomas Charles went to London and he told Mary's story to the evangelical leaders of the Clapham sect, that same network that included William Wilberforce and his associates. He asked them, quote, "If there are Mary Joneses in Wales, are there not Mary Joneses throughout the world?" Unquote. That question landed with such weight that in 1804, the British and Foreign Bible Society was founded. It was the first organization devoted specifically to the translation, printing, and global distribution of the Christian scriptures. Every major Bible society that came after it, the American Bible Society, the Gideons, every organization that has put a Bible in a hotel room or a hospital ward or a foxhole, traces its lineage back to that founding, which traces its lineage to a Welsh girl who walked 26 miles for a book she couldn't afford. The American side of the story began in 1792 when a handful of churches in New England started doing what the British had been doing, praying specifically and regularly for revival. In Lenox, Massachusetts, a pastor noted that not a single young person had been received into the church in 16 years. That statistic will tend to focus a pastor's prayers. By 1794, a group of pastors sent a letter to every congregation in the United States calling for a national concert of prayer, modeled directly on what was happening in England, modeled in turn on Edwards' 1748 vision. Presbyterians adopted it en masse. Congregationalists, Baptists, Moravians, they all joined in. On the first Monday of every month, Christians across the young nation were praying for awakening. They prayed for 4 years. In 1798, the Second Great Awakening began in earnest in the United States. In the eastern cities, the awakening was relatively quiet. Churches that had 5 dozen members grew to several hundred. Whole communities shifted, but it was in the West, Kentucky, Tennessee, Ohio, where things went kind of wild. Remember the frontier from last episode. It was largely unchurched, lawless, the kind of place where Kentucky had held only one court of law in 5 years, and a group of vigilantes had taken on the outlaws, and they had lost. This was the soil into which the Second Great Awakening was about to be planted. James McCready was the pastor of 3 small churches in Logan County, Kentucky, a place so rough it was known locally as Rogue's Harbor. McCready himself was not an appealing figure. He was described as physically striking in the wrong direction. He had a coarse voice, a plain manner, and a face that could stop a clock at 20 paces. One observer wrote that he was so ugly he attracted attention. Well, the Holy Spirit apparently has never required good looks. In 1799, McCready described the state of his ministry as, quote, "weeping and mourning with the people of God," unquote. But a year later, it was weeping, but with rejoicing. In the summer of 1800, a wave of the Spirit broke over his congregations and spread across the county. The physical churches on the frontier were just too small for what was happening. They were tiny log buildings that seated maybe a few dozen, but they were suddenly now drawing hundreds. The solution was practical and accidental. Move outside. Preachers began gathering people in open campsites where families would travel from miles away and stay for 3 or 4 days. Several preachers would take turns. People would camp, they would pray, they would hear the word preached through the night. Now, the camp meeting that defined that era was held at Cane Ridge, Kentucky in August of 1801. It was led by a Presbyterian minister named Barton Stone. Estimates of attendance range from 10,000 to 20,000 people, which, to give you a sense of scale, was more than the population of the young nation's largest cities. People came from hundreds of miles and from every direction. The outdoor preaching continued around the clock. When one preacher exhausted himself, another would take over. What happened in the crowd was extraordinary and controversial in equal measures. People were reported to fall to the ground under conviction of sin. Some wept uncontrollably. Some people shook. Some laughed. Some barked. Yeah, barked, like dogs. Though historians debate whether that's really a description of the sound or maybe mockery coined by those that were observing. What almost everyone agreed on, friend and skeptic alike, was that people were genuinely and dramatically converted. The behavioral extravagances disturbed many observers, including some of the preachers themselves, but the fruit, it was simply undeniable. Dr. George Baxter, a Presbyterian minister from Philadelphia, was a confirmed skeptic. He heard the reports from Kentucky, and he went specifically to investigate whether any of this was real or merely some kind of mass hysteria. He came back with a report that rattled his colleagues. Kentucky, he said, was the most morally transformed place he had ever visited in his entire life. He had not heard a single profanity his entire time that he was there. A sense of reverence, he said, quote, hovered over the countryside like a presence, unquote. Well, the revival swept out of Kentucky into Tennessee and Ohio and the broader frontier. Those converted on the frontier, many of them traveled east to go to seminaries to get their degrees and then came back to plant churches and to start colleges. Three quarters of the colleges in what we now call the Midwest were founded as a direct result of the Second Great Awakening. The frontier that had been spiritually empty in 1798 was studded with colleges and churches by 1830. Now, the revival was as evident among the enslaved population of the South as among the white settlers, a fact that would have enormous implications for the decades ahead, both for the church and for the nation. As the frontier awakening began to crest, a young upstate New York lawyer had a conversion experience in 1821 that he later described as receiving, quote, a mighty baptism of the Holy Spirit, unquote. Charles Grandison Finney. He went from the law office to the pulpit, and he never looked back. Finney's revivals in upstate New York through the 1820s were effective and controversial in about equal measure. He brought what he called new measures to revival meetings. He called people by name in prayer, which was considered kind of scandalous. He allowed women to pray aloud in mixed gatherings, again, outrageous. He introduced what was called the anxious seat. Now, this was a designated row at the front where people under conviction of sin could sit, publicly signaling their openness to be counseled and led to faith. Every modern altar call, every come forward if you want to receive Christ moment that you've ever seen at an evangelistic meeting or a church, descends in direct line from Finney's anxious bench. Finney began his major revival campaign in 1824 in New York State, and his greatest work came in Rochester, New York, in the winter of 1830 to 31. Rochester was a boom town on the Erie Canal. It was prosperous, growing, and carrying all the moral problems that come with rapid wealth and a transient population. Finney came and stayed for 6 months. Shopkeepers closed their stores, put signs in the windows directing customers to the revival meetings. The town's taverns went out of business. In a city of 10,000, more than 1,000 people made professions of faith. Lyman Beecher, himself one of the greatest preachers of the era, called the Rochester Revival, quote, the greatest work of God and the greatest revival of religion that the world has ever seen in so short a time, unquote. Now, Finney moved to New York City in 1832. In 35, he joined the faculty of the newly organized Oberlin College in Ohio as professor of systematic theology, an institution that admitted students without regard to race or sex, which put it well ahead of its time. He became Oberlin's president in 1851. Finney's influence radiated far beyond his meetings. His book, Lectures on Revivals of Religion, published in 1835, was translated into French, German, Welsh. A young English draper's assistant named George Williams read it in London in 1844, was transformed, and went on to found the YMCA. The Holiness Movement, and eventually the Pentecostal movement trace significant threads of their theological DNA to the perfectionist emphasis that developed at Oberlin under Finney's teaching. The Second Great Awakening, it wasn't merely a spiritual event. It was one of the most consequential social forces in all of American history. The abolition movement was sustained and energized by the revival. Finney himself barred slave owners and traders from communion at his New York church, a statement that would have been noticed. The network of Oberlin students and faculty were among the most active conductors on the Underground Railroad. The theological logic was inescapable. If every person is made in God's image and stands equally before God in need of grace, then the institution of slavery is a theological contradiction. It isn't merely a social inconvenience. Thousands of schools were founded at this time. Hospitals, orphanages, also organized right now and as a result of the Second Great Awakening. The Sunday School movement, which had begun in England partly as a literacy program for working-class children who had no access to weekday education, became a major institution of American life. Organizations to help the poor proliferated during this time. When historians describe the mid-19th century United States as a Christian nation, they're describing it in large part the cultural and institutional legacy of the Second Great Awakening. The nation that went into that period looking like it might lose Christianity entirely came out of the other side with Christianity woven into the fabric of its laws, its schools, its voluntary organizations, and its very public culture. The War of 1812 interrupted the revival. Wars do that, but it couldn't stop it. Well, you know, by the 1850s, the country was prosperous. Midwest was being developed. The economy was booming. People were making 18% returns on their investments. And the church, as has happened with dismaying regularity throughout history, it was beginning to coast. When things are going well, it's easy to forget that the things going well are not the result of your own cleverness. Into this propensity walked two destabilizing forces that fed off of each other. The first was the slavery question. It wasn't just tearing the country apart politically, it was tearing denominations apart at the seams. The Baptist split in 1845 over slavery. Methodist split in 1844. Presbyterians split in stages. The same revival that had energized the abolition movement had also converted millions of Southerners who had found ways to make theological peace with slavery. The church was not speaking with one voice. It was barely speaking to itself at all. The second destabilizing force arrived in the form of a former army captain and a New York farmer named William Miller, who'd come to faith after the War of 1812 and spent the next 14 years in intense study of biblical prophecy. And Miller's conclusions were earnest and they were systematic and they were wrong. Working from Daniel chapter 8, verse 14, and the day-year interpretive principle, he became convinced that Christ would return about the year 1843 or maybe 44. He began preaching that in 1831, and by the early 1840s, he'd attracted a following of several hundred thousand people across multiple denominations. Baptists, Methodists, Congregationalists, Presbyterians, they all got caught up in prophetic expectation. As the date drew closer, the preparations became extreme. People sold their farms. They gave away their businesses. They stopped planting crops. On October 22nd of 1844, an estimated 100,000 people gathered in their homes, or churches, or fields across the Northeast, waiting for the Lord to return. The day passed, nothing happened. In Millerite communities across the region, the sunrise of October 23rd was greeted with what one observer called, quote, "the most profound silence I ever heard," unquote. The event became known as the Great Disappointment. Those who'd given away everything, they were ruined. And of course, the skeptics piled on with undisguised glee. Across the country, faith itself, not just Millerism, faith itself was damaged from the debacle. From the wreckage of Millerism, a new movement eventually emerged, the Seventh-day Adventists. Story for another time. By the mid-1850s, the spiritual momentum of the Second Great Awakening had exhausted itself. Economic prosperity had dulled spiritual urgency. The national conversation about slavery was consuming the moral energy that had once driven reform. The denominational splits over slavery had weakened the institutional church. It looked in certain ways like 1798 all over again. But it wasn't. In 1857, a man named Jeremiah Lamphere hung a notice on the door of a church on Fulton Street in Lower Manhattan. It invited people to come pray during the lunch hour. He expected perhaps 40 people. On that first day, 6 showed up. By the third week, the room was full. By the following year, 10,000 people were gathering for noonday prayer across New York City. Within 2 years, an estimated 1 million Americans had come to faith in what historians call the Fulton Street Revival, or sometimes simply the prayer meeting revival. It was happening again. Now, we're going to talk about that next time. Now, thanks for watching our church history series here on the Enduring Word YouTube channel. I'm Pastor Lance. If this series has been a blessing for you, would you share it with a friend who loves history or loves the church or maybe who just needs to be reminded that what looks like the end is often the beginning of something that God has been setting up for decades? Subscribe, leave a comment, and we'll see you next time.